The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
There are many rules concerning how money works with you or against you. How do you know if you're playing the money game the right way? Welcome to Cultivate Your Financial Health with your host, Wayne Feierbaugh. He'll teach you how the rules of money now can affect the choices, how many or how few, you'll have throughout your lifetime. Now, here is your host, Wayne Feierbaugh.
I am Wayne Feierbaugh, and I am so glad that you're joining me for Cultivate Your Financial Health here on the Voice America Variety Talk Network. You know what? Today, we are going to try to talk all issues related to the lifelong process of growing and curating your wealth. Now, give the phone number, and it's a toll-free number if you want to chime in, 866-472-5788. Hey, it's the network's dime, so feel free to call. But there's other ways to get me, too. You can tweet me. My Twitter handle is at Wayne Feierbaugh. Shoot me an email to radio@cultivateyourfinancialhealth.com or check out my website, waynefeierbaugh.com. Well, what do we got on tap today? Well, today's show, I'm going to ask you a question, and I'm going to try to answer it for you, too, but how do you measure your financial health? Have you ever thought about it? If you were doing that, if you were measuring your financial health, what metrics would you consider? Would you think about your income? How about the size of your portfolio? What about the value of your house? The stability of your job? Maybe you'd look at something else entirely. But how exactly would you measure your financial health? And if once you did measure it, what would that measurement process tell you? Would it show that you've recovered financially from the Great Recession, or are you still lagging a bit behind? Well, new data from the Census Bureau suggests that the average American is worse off than before the Great Recession. In fact, the average American is even in worse financial shape than at the beginning of this century. Yeah. Now, you think of the beginning of this century, sometimes it's hard to wrap our mind around. But, you know, it's just been 14 short years since we began this century. So many Americans are worse off today than they were back at the beginning of this century. So that's the first thing we're going to talk about today. How do you measure your financial health, and what would it tell you if you did measure it? Another thing I want to ask you is, well, I got a question. Did you celebrate the big holiday last week? No, I don't have my weeks confused so that I really meant Labor Day. No, that's not the holiday I'm referring to, nor am I referring to International Bacon Day, that commemorative milestone where we celebrate our collective 1.7 billion pounds of bacon consumption each year, which translates to about 18 pounds individually. No, I'm not talking about that holiday either. No, I'm talking about a much bigger holiday than that. Don't tell me you missed it. That was the birthday that my daughter and I share. You did? Well, don't worry. Don't worry if you missed it. There's still time to send me something embarrassingly expensive in care of the network. Hey, teasing aside, celebrating a birthday with my firstborn reminded me that financial planning is often about managing the transitions in your life. I wonder, could there be any greater transition than going from non-parenthood to parenthood in a single day? I think not. So as we go through that transition period, it gives us something to think about with respect to our financial planning, whether we're a parent or whether we're not. So let's get to it. My first question of the day was, how do you measure your financial health? What metrics would you consider? Well, there's a great article that appeared a couple days ago in credit.com and then was repeated on MSN Money and talked about the fact that there are often two ways that people will measure how they're doing financially. The first, how much they earn. Second, how much they own. Oftentimes, we concentrate less on or give less attention to how much we own. I mean, we know it, you know, the size of my brokerage account, my retirement account, how much my house is worth. But sometimes we don't really focus quite as much on that piece of the equation, how much I own. Well, I will tell you, this is actually where many planners, including myself, began a financial planning engagement. we begin by preparing a balance sheet for the family. I need to know what the assets and the liabilities are. Well, if this is one of the ways that you measure your finances, it's very likely that you own a lot less than you did before the Great Recession. In fact, odds, according to Credit.com, are about 50-50 that you own less than you did in the year 2000. Now, this isn't just made up by the folks at Credit.com or by me. This is according to the latest census data. Now, last week, the Census Bureau released new figures on net worth. And the Census Bureau broke net worth down into quintiles, or fifths. So the top 20%, then 20 to 40, 40 to 60, 60 to 80, and then 80 to 100. Now, net worth is a fairly simple calculation, but it is enormously important. It's basically to get your net worth. You take the value of your house, your savings, your retirement accounts, any other assets you have, and you subtract your debts, things like your mortgage, any credit card debt. Now, you have some student loans, there you subtract those too. So, for example, if you have a house that's worth $400,000 and you have a $300,000 mortgage on it, well, that's going to count as a net $100,000 asset. Well, the Census Bureau released data for 2000, 2005, and 2011. Now, this means that today is not quite up to date, but it's still very, very informative. What the Census Bureau's data shows is that all five quintiles, whether you're in the top 20% or the bottom 20%, all five quintiles own less than they did in 2005. 2005, well, that was the height of the housing bubble. And housing values have a big impact on net worth measures, at least in the top three quintiles, the top 60%. You get to the bottom quintile, most of those folks are renting, and so the housing doesn't affect them as much. So if you, this is particularly concerning once you dig into the numbers, and you can see how significant this effect is on the middle class. The richest fifth of Americans, the top 20%, the median net worth of that group dropped 19%. Now, that is a big number. You think about losing almost 20% of your net worth over a few year period. That is just harsh. But in the middle class group, the bottom groups, net worth dropped from $106,591 to $68,839. That is a 35% difference. So in that middle group, the 40 to 60%, the folks who are firmly in the middle of Americans, they had an enormous drop. And the middle class, well, they lost more than one, you think about that, they lost more than one third of their net worth between 2005 and 2011. Now, drop down a quintile, go down to the 60 to 80%ers, if we want to call them that. We talk a lot about the 1%ers, but we'll talk about the 60 to 80%ers. They saw even worse punishment. The 60 to 80%ers lost more than half of their net worth. Well, even pretty well-off Americans in that second group, the 20 to 40%ers, they lost more than a quarter of their wealth, about 26%. Now, go up to the top end of the scale again, and you're going to see that folks have assets that are roughly equal to 1 year's wages. Well, you know what? If you think about that, you have assets enough to supply basically 1 year worth of your living expenses. It is no wonder that so many Americans rely on Social Security to help get them through their retirement. You know, even folks in the top, once you get into the middle quintile, many of these folks have assets, again, roughly equal to a year's worth of their income. It's going to be very, very difficult for them to retire. Now, another alarming story. The bottom two quintiles have lost ground since 2000, so the bottom 40%. You think about that. These people from 2000 to 2011, they've worked. They've perhaps gone to school, maybe got a new degree. I mean, they have hopes. They have dreams just like us, just like you, just like me. But that substantial part of the population owns less than it did at the turn of the century. I mean, and even the next two groups, the 40 and 80%ers, they have only seen their assets grow by less than 10% during that period of time. It's no wonder that many of us don't feel like we're getting anywhere. There's a good chance we're not. So how to solve it? Well, the gentleman who wrote this article, a guy named Bob Sullivan at Credit.com, he suggests that Congress should consider an asset tax. So as you have more assets, the Congress should consider an asset tax instead of, or perhaps in addition to, the income tax. Well, in my humble opinion, that's not a great idea. I mean, if you think about the assets that people have, think many of them are illiquid, meaning they can't be gotten rid of easily. So if you think about the fact that assets are illiquid or they would be expensive or time-consuming to get rid of, or they're held in retirement accounts where you'd have negative tax consequences if you did get rid of them, I'm not sure that an asset tax is a great idea. Plus, how does the government taking money solve the problem? I mean, even if the government were to take money from the top 20% or the top 40% and distribute it to the bottom 60%, would that this seems to me like perhaps a short-term solution. So I'm not sure we can expect realistic government help to move you from the bottom or the second tier of the bottom up to the top. But for purposes of cultivating your financial health, there's a couple things that I would like you to do. The first step, as it relates to your net worth, is to calculate your net worth. And the way that I do it is I simply on one side, I will say on the left side, I will list my assets. And so it's going to be my retirement account. I'm going to put my brokerage account, my house, maybe if I have some art collections or if I have a business, that's all going to go on the left side of the ledger. And I'm going to sum all of my assets. On the right side of the ledger, I'm going to list all the people that I owe. So if I have some credit cards or student loans or a mortgage or any debts that I have are going to be on the right side of the ledger. And I'm going to sum all the amounts that I owe, all the debts that I have, all the liabilities, those are all the same term, money that I owe other people. And so I take the total of my assets minus my liabilities. If I have a positive number, that means I have a positive net worth. If I have a negative number, well, that means I have a negative net worth. And so I'm going to get a sense of what I have. I'm going to first calculate my net worth. And I'm going to pay particular attention within my assets to what types of things are productive assets and which types of things are non-productive assets. Let me give you an example. Perhaps you own a set of grandma's china, and you're very attached to it. And grandma's china is worth something. Maybe it's $1,000 or $5,000, or maybe your grandma really had an extravagant set of china and it's worth $50,000. That's fantastic, and you should include that, but it's not really a productive asset. Just sticking grandma's china in your china cabinet is going to be nice, and you'll display it, and maybe you even eat on it at the holidays, but it's not going to really help your assets grow. As opposed to something, for example, like your retirement account, your 401k. You know, hopefully you will have some market growth in that. Maybe even your home value, you'll have some increase in value there. I think of assets that are productive versus assets that are non-productive. But I'm going to, regardless, even if I don't take it that far, I'm going to spend some time and I'm going to check and I'm going to calculate my net worth. The second thing I'm going to do is I'm going to start looking at I'm going to create a spending plan. And that's just a code word for a budget. I know it's a dirty word, but we're allowed to say that one on the radio. So I'm going to create a budget. And if you think about it, if I earn $5,000 a month and I spend $4,000, I should be increasing my net worth every month by $1,000. Now, as a practical matter, most of us don't do that, but it is theoretically possible. So I want to calculate a spending plan and figure out how much each year I should be adding to my how much I should be adding to my net worth. After I've created my spending plan, I'm going to create an investing plan. You know, another way that I can increase my net worth is by creating an investment strategy. So I not only thinking about how much I should be contributing, but how should I position my assets to grow? Do I have assets that are invested too conservatively? Might I make some of my assets invested a bit more aggressively so that they grow and can contribute to ever-increasing amounts of net worth for me? So do they increase the asset side of my ledger? So I'm going to create an investing plan. Remember, higher returns do equal more opportunity for market volatility. Many of us will call that more opportunity for investment risk. But over time, I should have higher long-term returns, which over time hopefully will increase my net worth. And the last thing I'm going to do with respect to my net worth after I've created my net worth statement is I'm going to create a debt payment plan. Now, if you think about it, if I increase my assets by a dollar or I decrease my liabilities for by a dollar, I've increased my net worth in either scenario by a dollar. It's going to have the same effect on my net worth, whether I increase assets or reduce liabilities, same effect on my net worth. However, unless the asset is a productive asset, paying debt may have a bigger effect on my net worth over time than adding to my assets. And for this reason, if someone loans me money, they naturally are going to expect some sort of interest payment, right? Well, those interest payments are going to reduce my income. They're going to affect my spending plan, which is going to make it so that I am able to add less money to my net worth. So, all things being equal, as I start to think about this, I'm going to create a debt payment plan that allows me to start reducing the debt side of my ledger, maybe even sometimes before I work on the expense side, before I work on the asset side of my ledger, so that I can begin to increase my net worth. So, go back to the question: how do you measure your financial health? What metrics would you consider? Well, certainly think that you should consider your income. But I'm hoping that you also consider your net worth. And if you're like many Americans, your net worth has suffered since the Great Recession. Your net worth has suffered since the turn of the century. However, it is difficult to improve something that you're not concentrating on, that you're not monitoring. And I would like you to start monitoring your net worth. The only way to do that is to begin by calculating your net worth. So again, on one side of the ledger, list all your assets. On the other side of the ledger, list all the amounts you owe to other people. The difference is your net worth. Now that you know your net worth, begin putting into place some plans. Create a spending plan. Create an investment plan. Create a plan for paying off your debt. And before you know it, hopefully you will start to see your net worth increase. I am Wayne Farbaugh. I'm a CPA and a certified financial planner. When we get back from the break, we're going to spend some time talking about the holiday that I bet you didn't celebrate last week. Well, we're not going to really talk about that holiday. We're going to talk about the transitions in your financial life and the fact that financial planning is designed to help us manage those transitions. And is there really any greater transition than going from non-parenthood to parenthood in a single day? I think not. You want to get involved in the conversation, though? Give me a call, 866-472-5788, or send me an email to radio@cultivateyourfinancialhealth.com after the break.
Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now, 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your question. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com.
Listen for MD Radio on the Voice America Variety Channel.
That's Muscular Development Radio.
Every Monday, your host, Sean Ray, will take you inside the world of bodybuilding and health and fitness. The show will feature Hall of Fame bodybuilders, trainers, judges, and the future champions of tomorrow. Plus, you'll be invited to participate in our call-in Ask the Pros feature. And our nutritional spotlight will feature products that can help you achieve your fitness goals. MD Radio is broadcast live Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 Pacific, on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Each week, Jimmy Gould brings you the stories and the people that you want to hear about. Tune in to A Current Life to hear about the journey to success, how our guests became the people they are today, and the highs and lows they experienced along the way. Each hour will leave you inspired and entertained as Jimmy gets up close and personal with every week's guest and shares ideas you can identify with and apply to your own life. A Current Life with Jimmy Gould airs Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific Time, on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Get the news on our shows and other happenings by following us on Twitter. Find us at VoiceAmericaTRN or Twitter.com/VoiceAmericaTRN.
You are listening to Cultivate Your Financial Health with Wayne Farbaugh.
To connect with the show today, please call 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to radio@cultivateyourfinancialhealth.com. Now, back to this week's show.
Welcome back to Cultivate Your Financial Health. I am Wayne Fireball, your host. I'm a certified public accountant and a certified financial planner who is here to help answer those questions that everyday people have about money. Things like about taxes, insurance, investing, estate planning, whatever's on your mind, let you and me try to tackle it together, okay? You can get me at 866-472-5788. Hey, it's the network's dime, so call early and call often. Or you can tweet me. My Twitter handle is @WayneFireball. My email, radio@cultivateyourfinancialhealth.com. And my website is WayneFireball.com. I probably should spell it because I know Fireball is not a very common name in many parts of the country. I mean, you may think it's a great name or a weird name, but if you're going to reach out to me, you got to know how to spell it. Fireball does not have any L's in it. It's F-I-R-E-B-A-U-G-H. And if you want to talk between shows, maybe you're a little shy, don't want to come on in the air and talk about money, I understand. You can get me between shows at 855-WAYNE-11. Well, I think that takes care of all the housekeeping stuff. Well, last week, my daughter and I shared a birthday. She turned 12, and I turned something, well, a little bit more than 12. You know, it's not polite to ask people how old they are. But it got me to thinking about kids and the transition points in our life. And kids, oh my gracious, did you see this study a couple weeks ago from the U.S. Department of Agriculture about what it costs to raise a child? Now, I don't know why the U.S. Department of Agriculture is the organization within the government doing this study, but they've been doing it since the 1960s. And the average cost nationwide to raise a kid from birth to age 18 is a cool $250,000. A cool $250,000 to raise your kids. But you know what? That doesn't even include college. So we're going to talk about that in a minute as well. But cool $250,000. And if you live in certain areas of the country, for example, if you live in the Northeast, it costs even more. Well, you know, it's not all about the money. It's hard to, although it may be hard to look at your kids and not see them as little money drains, but it's not all about the money. Think of it as the transition in your life. And you know what? That's what financial planning is designed to assist you in doing, manage transitions. I think of transition points in life as when your income or your sources of income change, or when your standard of living changes. Let me give you some examples. Let's say, for example, you're married and you have the death of the breadwinning spouse, the income-earning spouse. Well, at that point, clearly, your income sources, your source of income changes. That is a transition point in your life. Oh, but what if you have one spouse as the homemaker? Not to be stereotypical, but perhaps it's the wife stays home with the kids. And what happens when that spouse, if that spouse were to pass away? Well, that is a standard of living change. If you think perhaps you never thought about that. But when the stay-at-home spouse, if the stay-at-home spouse were to pass away, the remaining surviving spouse, maybe the income-earning spouse, but they're going to see their work schedule is necessarily going to have to change. This family's expense structure is going to have to change as you do things like having to get counseling for the kids, or you have to adjust your work schedule so that you don't travel so much, maybe take a different job. And so that is a transition point in your life. What about if an income-earning spouse gets disabled? Well, you have the loss of ability to work, loss of ability to earn income. Well, again, this is a transition point in your life. What about a divorce? Generally, you think of divorces as personal divorces, and many marriages do end in divorce. So we have personal divorces, a transition point in your life. But we also have business divorces. I see a lot of business divorces. You know, folks enter a business together, think they're going to create something, going to work together towards a common financial good, and at some point down the line, they have a business divorce. What about a home purchase? You know, you save for some period of time and eventually you're able to move into a starter house or perhaps even your dream house. That is a transition point in life. And then, of course, we have the holy grail of transition points when you transition from a working life to a retirement life. This is what many people focus on, but it's clearly a transition point. It is a time in life when your income changes, when your source of income changes, and probably even your standard of living changes as well. Well, this is what financial planning is designed to do. You get the idea. These are all life transitions involving changes of income or standard of living. And again, this is what financial planning is designed to help you evaluate, consider, and develop choices with respect to these transition points. So, transitions. Well, kids are clearly one such area of transition. I mean, if you have natural kids, you're their birth parents, you have less than a year to prepare. I mean, even if you've been trying to have kids for some period of time, once it happens, you have less than a year to prepare. And then all of a sudden, there they are. Both of my children are adopted, so perhaps in that way I'm a bit more fortunate. Sometimes you have a little bit more than a year to prepare, given how long adoption takes. But regardless, one day you're not a parent, and the next day you are. Well, so this occurred to me last week as, again, my daughter turned 12 and I turned more than 12. And it got me to thinking about the transition of parenthood. So I wanted to share some financial planning considerations for kids. Now, maybe your kids are gone or maybe you don't have kids. Don't tune me out because many of these transition items work for you as well. They're good financial planning things to help plan for your transition points in life as well. But the first thing that does specifically apply to families that have kids is college. You know, college is one of the biggest individual costs associated with raising kids. I mean, the U.S. Department of Agriculture says it takes about $250,000 to raise a kid, but that didn't include college costs. They cut the calculations off at age 18. Well, to give you an example, in my home state, I live in Virginia. Virginia's two flagship universities are Virginia Tech and the University of Virginia. At Virginia Tech says their cost of attendance for the 2014 to 2015 school year is $19,941. Now, depending on where you live, that's either a bargain or not, but among public universities, it's a pretty good bargain. See, the College Board said in 2013 to 2014, a moderate public university average was $22,876. So I guess in Virginia, with Virginia Tech, we're fairly fortunate. University of Virginia, our state's other flagship university, the cost of attendance is $23,506, unless you're in the engineering school, and then they're going to tag you for another $2,000. Well, that sounds like an awful lot of money, and it is an awful lot of money, but there's another piece to this. See, if I just had my child, I just began my transition into parenthood, now I also have inflation. What 6% inflation? Virginia Tech, 4 years of Virginia Tech, that $19,941. In 18 years, 6% inflation becomes $228,000. 4 years of Virginia, University of Virginia, $23,506. In 18 years, 6% inflation becomes almost $268,000. Well, this costs as much as the first 18 years of my kid's life. It's no wonder parents are stressed. It's no wonder parents are worried. And it's also no wonder that this is one of the first things that when new parents try to do is to start figuring out how they're going to save for college. So financial planning for college part of the transition into parenthood and as your kids transition as well, because you think about it, college is part of your kids' transition as well. They're transitioning from high school to adulthood. And college is the corridor through which they go to make that transition oftentimes. So financial planning for college is a transition for your entire family's life. So the first thing to do as you do this is estimate the cost. Now, you may not know if your kid's going to go to Virginia Tech or University of Virginia or Ohio State or Berkeley or wherever, but you oftentimes do have an idea of the type of school that you want to send your kid to. And, you know, so maybe you could do a range. You know, if I'm in Virginia, say my kid's going to go to one of the public universities, well, Virginia Tech's $19,941, UVA's $23,506. Yeah, I'm going to use that as a range. So start to estimate a cost, and don't forget to apply the inflation. Secondly, after I determine the cost, figure out how much of that cost I, as a parent, want to fund. I call it my contribution target percentage. You know, I have talked to lots of families, and some of them say, you know what, we want to fund the entire cost of college. Okay, and it doesn't matter. Your answer may be different than mine. You have different life experiences. You have different values. You have a different way of raising your children. There's no right or wrong answer. You just need to figure out what your answer is. So after I've determined a cost, figure out how much I want to contribute. And so perhaps you say, you know what, I want to be able to have 50% of the college cost of college saved up. I want to have 75% saved up. Well, that's what you that is your goal, and if that's your goal, that's the correct goal. After I've determined my contribution target percentage, then I'm going to set a savings plan to reach that goal, to reach that dollar amount. I mean, it's just much like saving for retirement. You figure out the year in which you want to retire. You figure out how big your portfolio needs to be, and you back up and figure out how much you need to save to get to that goal. So after determining how much a college, a range of what college was going to cost, how much I want to fund for my kids, and maybe how much I want them to fund too, then I would set a plan to reach that goal. After I set a plan to reach that goal, then I have to implement. Now, for many families, the college saving vehicle du jour is a 529 savings plan. And incidentally, if you wonder where that term comes from, 529 comes from the section of the Internal Revenue Code that gives 529s their birth. So for many families, they're going to do a 529 savings account. But there are other ways to save for college as well. But if you decide to do a 529 savings plan, note that in some states, many states, you will get a state income tax deduction. Now, not all states have an income tax, but if your state has an income tax, oftentimes you will find you get an income tax deduction for state income tax purposes for 529 contributions or some part of your contribution. Here in the state of Virginia where I live, you get a $4,000 per year deduction for 529 contributions to the state plan. It's important to note, you only get the deduction if you contribute to your state's plan. If you live in Arizona, or Arizona is a bad example, you live in California and contribute to the Virginia 529 plan, well, you're not going to get a California state income tax deduction because you didn't contribute to the plan that's sponsored by the state of California. If you contribute to the California plan, yeah, then you might get a deduction. So next, after you set your savings plan goal, then you implement. And for me, again, many families, it's going to be a 529 savings plan. Oftentimes, you get a state income tax deduction, but you're not going to ever get a federal income tax deduction for 529 contributions. However, if you take the money out when your kid goes to school and use it for what the tax code refers to as qualified higher education expenses, and these are much like what you'd think they would be, things like tuition, room and board, books, the mandatory fees that every school seems to tack on. If you use your kid's 529 account for qualified higher education expenses, well, you can withdraw the amounts from the account tax-free. So all the amounts, if you over time you put $50,000 in the account and it grew to $150,000, you can withdraw that entire $150,000 to pay for college tax-free. So process. For one of the biggest transition points for our kids is first estimate a cost for college. And it could be a range where, you know, when you're 10, 15, 18 years out, that's all you can work with. You're not going to get exact, but we have to have something, some target that allows us to work towards. So estimate a cost, estimate a range, determine how much of that cost I want to fund through savings. Do I expect my kids to contribute? Do I plan to borrow some of it? Do I have other options available to me? So determine how much of it I want to fund through savings. Then after I've done that, set a savings plan to reach that goal. And finally, figure out the best vehicle for implementing that particular plan. For many families, it's going to be a 529 savings account. They have some great tax advantages to them, and so many families are going to find that that's where they're going to go. But explore other options as well, things like Coverdales or even individual retirement accounts if your kid happens to work for a job. So cost, estimate your cost, determine your percentage that you want to contribute, set a plan, implement a plan. You know what? This is the other thing about financial planning. This whole process is designed to set a set of reasonable expectations. You know, we all face choices in our financial lives, things that we can do and things that we cannot do. And financial planning and going following this process with respect to your kids' college education, your college savings approach, your college funding approach for your kids, is designed to set reasonable expectations. I mean, what can you realistically do and not do? It's so much better to know when your kids are younger. And so that is what we encourage folks to do. Another transition point things that I encourage folks to do is you start to look at kids. You know, yesterday you didn't have any kids. Today you have a kid. So much additional responsibility. It can feel quite heady. We can get a little nervous at that. So I encourage folks to also begin looking at their insurance portfolio. And there's two particular types of insurance that I really want folks to think about when they have kids. And I find that many families do. The first type of insurance is your life insurance. The second type of insurance that perhaps you don't focus on, but I'm going to encourage you to do, is your disability insurance. Okay, let's look at life insurance. There's two broad types of life insurance. We have term insurance and we have permanent or permanent insurance, or also known as cash value insurance. This is insurance that accumulates a cash value. So now, term insurance is just as it says. You know, I'll have it for a term of time, perhaps I have a 10-year term, a 20-year term, and I'll pay my premiums for that term of time. And then after that period of time, I stop paying premiums and I stop having coverage. Cash value life insurance has a cash component, a cash accumulation a bucket, as it were, a cash accumulation account that will accumulate cash. And because of that accumulation feature, I potentially can keep the policy for my entire life. Now, I don't want to debate the merits of either term or permanent cash value insurance here today. It seems to inflame passions. I mean, you have life insurance agents and brokers who swear by permanent cash value insurance, and they will talk about the tax benefits of cash value insurance. And you know what? They are right. On the other hand, you have fee-only financial planners who talk about the cost of life insurance and how very few families need permanent cash value life insurance. We're not going to get into that today, perhaps on a different show. But the point I do want to make is that for many younger parents, they're not going to be able to afford sufficient permanent cash value accumulation coverage to provide the full protection for what they need for their family. Many times when you have kids, when you're transitioning from non-parenthood to parenthood, you're going to find that you're going to need to buy term coverage. That's going to be the only way you can have enough coverage. If you look at the cash outlay, and lots of that's what we focus on month to month, paycheck to paycheck is the cash outlay. What many times you're going to find is that you can't afford enough permanent coverage to provide the protection that you need. So when we get back from break, we're going to spend some time thinking about this issue of life insurance. What exactly, when I use this phrase, can't afford the full protection, what exactly am I trying to protect with life insurance? Well, it's several things I'm trying to protect, and we're going to talk about that when we get back from the break. We're also going to spend some time talking about disability insurance, generally how it works, why it's important, and what you need to do with that. I am Wayne Fireball. I'm a CPA and a certified financial planner. You want to join the conversation? Well, you can get me toll-free on the network's dime. Hey, what better way to talk? 866-472-5788. You can also tweet me. I love to read my Twitter feed. My Twitter handle is @WayneFireball. Or send me an email to radio@cultivateyourfinancialhealth.com. I will see you after the break.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
Voice America Network proudly presents The Catherine Zox Show for women, men, children, and families. Catherine magically combines her compassion, experience, and talent to bring listeners a show that's upbeat, informative, and yes, a little sassy. Tune in every Wednesday at 7 a.m. Pacific Time, 10 a.m. Eastern, to The Catherine Zox Show on the Voice America channel.
The world we live in has become a crazy place. Poverty is at an all-time high in the wealthiest nation on earth. We keep calling on government to save us with new programs. And now, we have more people using food stamps than any time in our history. This problem continues to get worse. The answer to poverty is in our homes, churches, and communities, and through our children. Get the answers from The Mickey Ellison Show, Wednesdays at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, 11 a.m. Eastern, on Voice America Variety.
The Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station.
VoiceAmerica.com.
You are listening to Cultivate Your Financial Health with Wayne Feierbaugh. To connect with the show today, please call 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to radio@cultivateyourfinancialhealth.com. Now, back to this week's show.
Hi, I am Wayne Feierbaugh, your host here on Cultivate Your Financial Health. Hey, I am so glad you're spending part of your day with me. You know, I am a certified public accountant and a certified financial planner who's here to try to help answer those questions that everyday people have about money. You ever wonder about things like taxes, insurance, investing, estate planning, college funding? Well, whatever's on your mind, let's try to tackle it together. It gave out the number at the top of the segment, 866-472-5788. Hey, it doesn't cost you anything to call, so connect with me. You can also get me by Twitter. My Twitter feed is at Wayne Feierbaugh. Email radio@cultivateyourfinancialhealth.com. And you want to get me between shows? For whatever reason, you want to come on the air and talk, I understand. I used to be shy myself. So you can get me between shows at 855-WAYNE-11. That's 855-WAYNE-11. Still toll-free, but only works between shows. Well, we're talking today about transitions in our life. And one particular transition, the transition from not being a parent to being a parent. I mean, one day you wake up and you're a parent. And they thrust that little bundle into your arms, and now you're a dad or you're a mom. And so financial planning often deals with managing transitions in our life. And is there any bigger transition than becoming a parent? I'm not sure there is. So last segment, we talked about funding college. We also started to talk about insurance. When you're a parent, you need one of the things you should do is this transition of your life is review your insurance. So we talked about two particular types of insurance that you want to consider now that you're a parent. The first is life insurance. And we talked about the two broad types, term versus permanent. They both have their fans. They both have their detractors. We started talking, though, about what is it exactly that I'm trying to protect. See, insurance is one of those things that nobody really likes to buy it. And I hear people tell me all the time, I don't want to be insurance poor. I understand that. Sometimes, though, it helps to understand exactly what is it that I'm trying to protect. Well, the first thing I'm trying to protect when I have kids is I'm trying to protect their my income. You know, if I earn $50,000 a year and I'm the primary breadwinner in my house, I need to protect that income from my spouse so that they can continue to support my kids. So the first thing I'm trying to do is I'm trying to protect my income. Another thing I'm trying to protect is college. You know, because now that I'm not here, I've passed on, gone to my great reward in the afterlife. My kids, I still want them to be protected. I still want them to get to go to college. So I need to protect their college fund. I'm not working now to contribute to their college. So I want their contribution to their college fund to continue. Another thing that I'm working to protect is lifestyle changes. Now, you didn't see that one coming, did you? You thought about college, you thought about debts, you thought about income, but lifestyle changes. And what exactly do you mean? Well, it's easier for you if I give you some examples. If a spouse passes away, ask yourself, will the surviving spouse be able to maintain the same work schedule? You know, you have the hard charging executive working, passes away. The other spouse, is also hard charging. Are they going to be able to continue to maintain that same work schedule? You know, now you have one parent instead of two. One parent to go to the school events. One parent to do pickup at school. One parent to help make sure homework gets done. One parent to make sure meals get prepared, grocery shopping is done. Is one parent going to be able to carry the load of two? Well, I know there are lots of single parents out there, and I got to tell you, they're some of the folks that have my greatest admiration, but it's a tough life. And so your family's gone through trauma. Your family's gone through an unexpected transition. So lifestyle change. this is one of the things I'm trying to protect. Will the surviving spouse be able to maintain the same work schedule? Oftentimes, I have found the answer to be no. Perhaps now the surviving spouse can't travel for work like they used to. They have to reject a transfer. They have to change their job so they can be home at more regular hours. So that's a question you have to ask. The other thing is, will the changes to the surviving spouse's work schedule, will they affect that spouse's ability to save for retirement? You know, I see occasionally where a spouse passes away and the surviving spouse stays home for a couple of years. Well, it's awfully difficult to get back into the workforce. But your kids perhaps need you. And so not only do I have to provide income for that surviving spouse while they stay home, I also have to think about the fact that that surviving spouse, by reducing their work schedule or being out of the work environment for a while, they're not saving for their own retirement. So I have to think about that lifestyle change as well. Another thing is, as I start to think about lifestyle changes and things I'm trying to protect with insurance, I think consider, are the kids, my kids going to need counseling? I see lots of families where one spouse passes away. It's very traumatic. It's traumatic for the surviving spouse. But that surviving spouse oftentimes has some understanding of what's happened. Can you imagine what goes through the mind of a 5, 9, even 15, 16-year-old? Very difficult. Oftentimes I will discover that not only do the expenses actually go up after a spouse passes away, because many of the members of the family need counseling. They have to go to professional counselors. They have to spend some time together healing as a family. So you have to think about these types of lifestyle changes as you look at your insurance. And again, if you have kids, if you haven't looked at your life insurance, absolutely encourage you to do so. My rule of thumb, I like to think, given all these competing demands that I have and things I'm trying to protect, I like to look at least 15 to 20 times my earnings when I look at insurance. Now, I may not always be able to afford that amount. If I get 10 times, that's better than nothing. But if I can afford it, I want to look at 15 to 20 times. And so if I make $50,000 at my job, that's my salary, you know, it doesn't concern me to see you with $750,000 to $1 million of life insurance protection. Kind of goes back, though, to what we talked about. We began the discussion about life insurance. If I'm going to buy that in a permanent cash value accumulating contract, that is very difficult for many young families to afford. So many of those families are going to gravitate to term coverage so that they can get – it's more important, in my opinion, to have the coverage to do the protection rather than having the coverage that's going to accumulate cash value at this particular stage of your life. If you pass away while your kids are 5, 10, 15, even 18, it is more important that I have that substantial pool of money coming into the household to replace my income and these other types of things that I'm trying to protect. So that's where most families are going to get to. So at this transition point in my life, when I move from non-parenthood to parenthood, I want to think about my life insurance. It's absolutely, it's one of those critical must-do things. Another type of insurance that I really want to spend some time thinking about is my disability insurance. Now, disability insurance, if you think about what it does, is it replaces a percentage of my income if I cannot work. Maybe I get injured. Maybe I have an illness and I can no longer work. So disability insurance replaces a percentage of my income if I can no longer work. And now, it's usually going to be limited to 2/3 or so of my income. And if you think about that, the insurance company's not going to replace 100% of my income. If they did, what would be my incentive to work? I mean, we would all want to be disabled. So the insurance company, they don't want to incentivize me to do what they call malinger. I love that word, malinger. They don't want to incentivize me to malinger, so they're usually going to limit my long-term benefits to somewhere about 2/3 of my pre-disability income. So if I make $100,000, probably I'm going to get about $67,000 of income from the disability carrier long-term, somewhere in that range. But the key for disability insurance is how it's taxed, how those benefits are taxed if I ever receive them. If I personally, if I, Wayne Fireball, pay the premiums for my checkbook, the insurance company drafts it every month out of my checking account. So if I pay it personally out of my checkbook, or I pay it through my employer, but I do it with after-tax payroll deductions. So it's not like my health insurance or my 401k that comes out before taxes are calculated. If it comes out after taxes are calculated, then benefits, if I receive them, are generally going to be tax-free. So in this example, if I earned $100,000 and I get $67,000 of benefits, that's generally going to be tax-free. But, and it's always a but, isn't there? But if my employer pays the premium as an employee benefit, then if I receive benefits, if I receive income from the disability contract in the future, well, I'm generally going to discover that that is going to be taxed. So do you see a potential problem here? Think about it. One day, I'm at 100% of my income. I'm working. I'm going to work. I'm earning 100% of my pay. I get disabled. I have an insurance contract that provides 70% of my pay. But my employer paid for it, so that 70% after tax becomes, let's say, 50%. So in a single fell swoop, I've moved through a transition point in my life where I can no longer work. I've gone from 100% to 70% with disability, but that disability benefit is taxed. So now I get somewhere maybe, say, 50%. So I need to consider this as I have kids. So a couple of things to think about with respect to this area of your life, with respect to this area of insurance. First, consider a buy-up disability policy. Now, unlike many other types of insurance policies, for example, life insurance or even annuities, you can buy these as what we call no-load, no-commission policies. I'm not aware of any no-load, no-commission disability policies. The fact is that there are many fewer companies selling disability insurance. So, but what I can do is find a reputable insurance broker and look at buying a disability buy-up policy. Now, be careful if they try to sell you something else you don't need, but you should look at disability buy-up policy, something that's going to move me from that 50% up to that 70%. So that's the first thing I want to do. Second thing I want to do is I want to keep up to date. You know, maybe 3 years ago I earned $80,000. Now I earned $100,000. Now I'm earning $100,000. I want to continuously monitor my disability insurance contract, because what I will discover is I will find that my family's expenses rise to meet our income. You know, we change our standard of living as our income increases, and so if I'm not changing my disability insurance contract to keep up with that, I can find that if I get disabled because I'm injured or ill and can't work, I will find that my disability benefits will not keep up. One last thing that I want to think about with disability. Disability, you know, under a life insurance contract, it's fairly simple. Did I die or did I not die? Disability contracts, I want to pay very close attention to the definitions within the contract. What do they define as disability? How long will they pay it? One particular area that I want to be particularly careful about is what they refer to as my occupation. Contracts can be divided into my own occupation or any occupation for which I'm reasonably suited. So if I'm a physician, I want to get a contract that covers me for acting as a physician, not as a contract that allows me to go teach, though that's a laudable profession. I want to get one that protects my particular occupation. So unlike many contracts, well, you should read all your insurance contracts, but particularly your disability contract, you want to understand and read the definition. How long is it going to pay you that 70% benefit? After 2 years, will you have to find some other sort of job? Will it pay you benefits for 5 years? Will it pay you benefits to you for 65 till you turn 65? Does it integrate with Social Security? These are all things that you need to understand with respect to your disability insurance contract. And so I encourage you, as you move through these transition points in your life, look at your disability insurance contract, look at your life insurance, and look at your life insurance contract. In the minute or two that we have left, I want to encourage you also, as you move through this transition point in your life, you move from non-parent to parent, spend some time with a competent attorney, so one that focuses on end-of-life planning, somebody who does wills, somebody who does trusts, and think about your end-of-life documents. Think about your wills, your trust, your beneficiary designation, your guardianship. We don't have time to get into all those today, but I encourage you, as part of your transition, as you move from non-parenthood to parenthood, think about those end-of-life documents. You know, my wife and I, a few years ago, when we traveled to Bulgaria to get our son, we were leaving our daughter here. We had to spend a great deal of time thinking about guardianship. I call these difficult conversations. None of us likes to think about dying, but we need to do that as we transition, as we think about this transition within our lives. I am Wayne Farbaugh, CPA and a certified financial planner. Hey, I want to thank you so much for spending part of your day with me. I hope you learned something that will help you cultivate your financial health. If you want to get me between shows, send me an email to radio@cultivateyourfinancialhealth.com or call me at 855-WAYNE-11. If you want to check in again, check out our rebroadcast this Saturday morning at 7 a.m. Pacific or 10 a.m. Eastern here on the Voice America Variety Network. Thanks much. Make it a great day. Bye-bye.
Now for the lawyer stuff. Information presented on Cultivate Your Financial Health is believed to be factual and up to date, but we do not guarantee its accuracy. It should not be viewed as personalized investment advice or as an offer to buy or sell any investments mentioned. All investments and strategies have the potential for profit or loss and may not be suitable for you. And as they say in the commercials, past performance does not assure future investment success. Cultivate Your Financial Health is sponsored by Wayne Farbaugh, Inc., a registered investment advisor with the state of Virginia. The firm only transacts business in states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration as an investment advisor is not an endorsement of the firm by securities regulators and does not mean that the advisor has attained a particular level of skill or ability. Our discussions should not be construed as legal or tax advice. Always consult an attorney or tax professional regarding your specific legal or tax situation. Whew, we're both glad that's finished. I am Wayne Farbaugh. If you want to contact me between shows, visit my website, waynefarbaugh.com, or call me at 855-WAYNE-11.
Thank you again for tuning in to Cultivate Your Financial Health. Please join Wayne Farbaugh again next Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 p.m. Pacific Time, or catch our weekend replay every Saturday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. We'll talk again soon.